Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is sound designer Scott Gershon. But first, we're going to talk about why opening acts lose money. Now, for many of you out there who don't have a record deal, or even if you do, one of the things that you're hoping for is to open up for a major act. And that might sound cool, and it is on many levels, but you're not going to make any money. And here's why. Everybody thinks that that's your big break. Opening for a major or a minor act or somebody that has some notoriety is your way to the future. It is occasionally, but most of the time it isn't. And most of the time it also puts you deep in debt. Why does that happen? Well, it costs a lot of money to do that. First of all, most tours require what they call a buy-in. That means that you actually have to pay the headlining act money to play on the same stage with them. How much? Well, this goes anywhere from about $2,000 a week to as much as $250,000 and up. So if there's a major, major headliner, it costs a lot more money. Now, the idea, of course, is you're going to be playing to the right people. Hopefully you will be. And for that, you'll be rewarded with exposure. But as you all know, when you go to a concert, the last thing you want to see many times and hear is the opening act, unless it's somebody you already know. So many times opening acts are treated pretty poorly. Now, that aside, it also costs a lot more money. And here's round numbers of what it costs to be on tour. It's anywhere between $7,500 and about $10,000 a week just for a bus and a trailer. So a tour bus is not an inexpensive item. It's something that's going to cost a whole bunch of dough. Why? Well, because you need a driver, first of all. Gas is cheaper these days, but a tour bus really guzzles a lot. And the fact of the matter is you need insurance as well, and that costs a lot of dough. The crew cost can be about $7,500 for a crew of six. That's a week, another $7,500. What do you get? Well, you're going to get your road manager, you're going to get a merch person, you're going to get a monitor engineer, maybe a house engineer, and a tech. And the tech could be a drum tech or a combination drum and guitar tech, bass tech, keyboard tech. So that's about six people. Don't forget you have to pay for per diems for these people as well. So you're paying salaries and per diems, or you're giving them money to basically buy food every day. And it's a lot of dough just to keep a crew going. Now, if you're bringing your own sound and lights and you're hiring them out, that's about another 10 grand a week. That being said, many times you'll be able to actually use what's available from the headliner. Many times they won't allow you to do that. They'll want you to have your own consoles, for instance, because they don't want to take up any inputs on theirs. Or maybe they'll only give you a few inputs, so in fact, you're much better off having your own anyway. That's a whole bunch of dough right there. And of course, the big problem here is the fact that it's costing you so much money that you probably don't have, that you have to go to the record label, if you're signed to one, and ask for tour support. Most record labels don't like to supply tour support anymore, but if they really believe in the act, they will. The only problem is it costs you yet again, because many times they'll ask for a 360 deal in return, meaning they're going to get a piece of your merch, meaning they're going to get a piece of everything coming into you. And of course, that's not something that you really want. So being an opening act can be a very expensive proposition. Another thing I want to talk about is a number of tools that are really inexpensive, under $100, that will really help your productivity. And these are some things that I use all the time, and I find them really worth their weight in gold. So the first thing that you can do if you really want to help your productivity, buy some more RAM for your computer. Everybody needs more RAM. It's not all that expensive, especially if you buy it from an aftermarket third party. For a Mac, for instance, I like to go to a company called Otherworld Computing, and you can get that at MacSales.com, MacSales.com. And they have Apple-certified RAM. So in other words, you can be sure that it's going to work, and there won't be a problem, and it's not going to cause any problems, and it's much, much cheaper than what you can get from Apple itself. So what I suggest is go and load up on RAM, and you'll be surprised how much faster everything feels and how much work you can do without any hiccups. Another thing I really like is a dedicated keyboard, and You can get dedicated keyboards for just about any DAW or any editor like Final Cut, for instance, if you go to editorkeys.com, editorkeys. And Editor Keys has a whole bunch of dedicated keyboards. They're about $100, and boy, they're worth it because all of your quick keys are there. All of your keyboard shortcuts are there, and it's really nice. If you don't want to pay for a dedicated keyboard, you can get a keyboard cover from a company called KB Covers, and I think it's kbcovers.com. It's a plastic cover that just slips over your normal keyboard. I have a couple of these. I have one for Final Cut, and I have another for Pro Tools. They're cheap, and they last a long time, and boy, they do the job. So that's something that you won't spend a lot of money on, but you'll find it'll help your productivity a lot. Another thing I really like is the Apple Magic Mouse. I'm not one for trackballs. As a matter of fact, trackballs make my elbow sore. So I love this Magic Mouse because it's basically a trackball and a mouse. Just by moving your finger or fingers across the mouse, you can do all sorts of things like changing pages, going up and down the page, etc., etc. And it's a very, very fast and easy way to move around a screen. So it's something I like to use. And again, that's less than $100. I think it's about 70. Well worth the money. Another thing that you ought to check out, there's a slew of smartphone music apps out there that will do all sorts of things that are usually less than $10, as a matter of fact. Let me give you one that I really like, and that's the Delay Genie. I like it because I designed it, and it's a good little app for free, by the way, that will allow you to actually set up your delay times. So you just tap in the delay, listen to a song, tap in the beat, and it will give you your delay times in quarter note, eighth note, 16th note, etc., plus using the straight note times or dotted notes or triplets. So that's a quick and easy way. And just go to the App Store and look for Delay Genie. Another thing I find indispensable is the Snark SN5 clip-on tuner. Clip-on tuner, I don't know how guitar players, bass players, anybody with a stringed instrument ever got by without it, because, boy, it's a quick and easy way to stay in tune. The Snark I especially like because it's about $10, and it works as good as anything. So look for that. The Snark SN5, you can get it on Amazon for $10 or a little less even. Something I really swear by is the Etymotic Research ER20 earplugs. Etymotic is E-T-Y-M-O-T-I-C and the ER20s. And this is the best $10 you'll ever spend because it will really save your hearing. I can't tell you the number of times I use these. Every loud situation I go into, I use these. Why are they worth it? Well, because they keep the frequency response the same. They just lower the level. So you can lower the level more by pushing them in your ear canal a little bit more, or you can get different ones that actually have different levels of attenuation. These things are fabulous. I can't say enough about them. The best $10 you'll ever spend because they'll really save your hearing. And finally, if you ever get into a situation where you just can't make a decision or you run into writer's block, Oblique Strategies originally were a deck of cards developed by Eno, musician Eno, and Peter Schmidt around 1975. And each one has a different direction for you to go. The direction is probably far away from what you ever considered. What this will do, it will put you into a different headspace if you just follow it, and will take you to new places that you never thought you'd take before, which is very cool when you're creating. So if you feel like you're doing the same old thing all the time, if you feel like you're stuck, try Oblique Strategies. And again, there's also an iPhone app, and I believe it's available for Android as well, Oblique Strategies. So those are some of the tools that I really like. They're less than $100, and they really help me, and I'm sure they'll help you too. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com and you can learn more. And also, you can get 4 free tricks. My guest today is one of Hollywood's top sound designers and a longtime friend, Scott Gershon. Scott has worked on over 100 films, including blockbuster movies like Pacific Rim, Gladiator, Hellboy, Star Trek, and games like Final Fantasy and Transformers. He's been nominated for 28 Golden Reel Awards, and he's won 10, and is also an Emmy nominee. I spoke with Scott from his studio via Skype. Scott, thanks for being with me. This is great.
My pleasure.
Let's start back at the beginning. You were a guitar player and a Berkeley boy. How does a guitar-playing Berkeley boy make it to Hollywood and become one of the top sound designers?
You know, for me, I've always liked the timbre of sound, the tonality of sound. So even as a guitar player, I was always into pedals and how things sounded. And I didn't realize how this path was taking me down a road. When I was at Berkeley, I was really into film scoring and engineering film scoring. And for me, even music in itself, I've always thought of it as telling a story. So I'd liked a lot more progressive rock, classical, a lot of music to me that had imagery in my head. So I went to Hollywood. I started engineering, did Cherokee Record Plant, started going down all the normal routes, and was with industry. So it was kind of the middle 80s. So the industry was having a good time. And, you know, I realized I was meeting some big engineers and some guys couldn't even afford a house. And I was kind of like, I don't know if this is a smart idea. So for me, the other passion I had was I was programming a lot of synths. And I got into programming synths for Chris Page and Mike Lang and a bunch of studio guys. And they would give me their Jupiter 8s and their DX7s and, you know, whatever was there. And I would do the complimentary, you know, clavinets and oboes and pianos and brass and come up with patches. Well, when I started getting into sampling and the keyboards, even though I was a guitar player, I thought it was more interesting where I was never just one synth. I would grab a DX7 because I liked the way it had a bite, a percussiveness. And then I would grab the thickness of a Roland and maybe a Prophet or an Oberheim and start building these really complex layers using MIDI, and MIDI was new at the time, to come up with these really cool patches, not within a synth, but within multiple synths. And then when I started playing around with them, I don't know, I you know, after a while you get on to make so many French horns and clavinets. So I started coming up with cool sounds. And a friend introduced me who was trying to create a workstation, a guy named Lance Ong and Jeff Berger. I was at a company where we were making sounds, and they needed a little clinician to show off a pseudo workstation. And I thought this was really cool. And I just started using it, and little by little, I didn't realize I was actually going down a path. So from then it went to how else can I get more money in addition to the engineering I was doing. And someone said, have you tried doing cartoons? So I started doing Defenders of the Earth and G.I. Joe and Transformers and all these little Saturday morning cartoons.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and you know, I said, well, you know what? It would be much better with samplers. So I grabbed the the Kai 612 or...
Oh, that, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So I started doing that and emus and you know, but it was like emu 1, emu 2, and started sampling them in. And at the time, I was heavily investigating Fairlight and Synclavier. And I said, you know, there's better ways to do this. So I did a cartoon, and someone said, no, you know, you want a better show. So I got a TV show called Beauty and the Beast. And I moved over to Taddeo Glenglen, where I was a synclavierist. I'm sorry. And before that, I was in Modern doing MacGyver.
And that's cool.
Then there was a day shift open at Taddeo, and I ended up doing Beauty and the Beast. And then a friend of mine, a mutual friend, who I kind of credit, a guy named Gene Gillette, who unfortunately is no longer with us, he said, I met a guy just like you. You guys would really get along. And he's, you know, likes to find people with technology. And there's a guy named Wiley Stateman, and he just created a brand new company called Sound Deluxe. So I came in, and at that time, interesting thing was happening as a synclavierist. Another company started coming into being. And I'd also worked with Hybrid Arts and ADAP because there was an Atari guy. Anyway, there was a company that was stealing employees from all over the industry and there was a brand new company called Waveframe. And they wanted me to check it out. And from there, I think I was the first one to post-production and maybe the third person in existence to use a sampler, because I was using Sinclair, and I said, you know, and I started becoming a clinician for them. And my big thing, what I would always do was I would grab a little metal pulley. I would drop it 5 octaves, add some reverb to it, and said, try that on a synclavier. Because it would just get grainy and crusty on a synclavier,
yeah,
and sound like whale calls because of the interpolation. And then they gave me one, and I started a movie called Honey Shrunk the Kids. And at that time, nobody was doing film. They were doing TV a little bit, but not film, digitally. So between my 8 app, I did Honey Shrunk the Kids, and then the Waveframe, and then I was kind of blessed within the first year in that, again, I was the, what is this kid doing? I did Honey Shrunk the Kids, Born in the Fourth, Glory, and Steel Magnolia within the first 18 months.
Wow.
And everyone went, who's the kid? I was in my mid-20s. So everyone's like, who is this kid? Oh, my God. And it was great. And everything I learned was from music, because when I look at guns and explosions, such like that, same thing as drum sets.
Yeah.
So I used a lot of the principles that I learned in recording music and as an engineer and as a musician, and just applied them to music. And the other thing I did, especially with a lot of the Oliver Stone films I did, was I was adding a lot of musicality. I would add stingers and a lot of music, which, is it music or is it sound design?
Mm-hmm.
So like on Heaven and Earth, I grabbed a taiko drums and tambolas and created all this chaos to make a scene very chaotic. Or I always had a musical approach to what I did. So, you know, I think there was a fine line between a composer, a sound effects guy, and then there was a sound designer on both sides, musically and sound effects, that kind of fit this little niche. So I was hitting stingers. And I kind of started adding techniques that seemed to make sense to me, which got me a lot of notice. And next thing I know, I got a film career.
That's very cool. But it's interesting how music really played a big part.
Massive.
And what I've found is, like editors, picture editors, for instance, musicians seem to make the best ones because they understand timing. They understand, especially if there's music involved, where the beat is. Where it breathes. You know?
Absolutely. There was a wonderful picture cutter named David Brenner, who was doing a lot of work with Oliver Stone, and he kept complimenting me about my musicality in my designs. And I said, you know, thank you, but the musicality is actually coming from you. Because the way he's cutting it, there's rhythms and sub-rhythms. And if I was just hitting the cuts, there was a rhythm going on.
Yeah.
And yes, I totally agree that I think there's an inner clock that all editors have, picture cutters and sound editors. And it's hard to quantify. Like when you lead into something in sync or lead into a cut, it's a feel. It's not go 6 frames exactly and it works.
Yeah.
Depends on the sound. And do you want to lead in? Do you want to lead out? How do you pace out a movie? And I think that it's almost a dance between the picture cutter and the sound department.
Wow. Take me through a project. So you get a call to do a new movie. What happens first?
I mean, usually, you know, I hear about a movie, I get a script. I can kind of hear soundtracks in my head when I read a script. So I'll hear something, an approach. You know, when I did American Beauty, I got interviewed and they said, you're an odd choice for this movie because you're a big sound designer. And, you know, again, I equated it to music again. And I said, well, it's kind of like music. You might think I'm heavy metal, but I've got a big jazz influence.
Mm.
And my vision when I met with Sam was negative space. You know, it's kind of a visual art form.
Yeah.
Said it's not what I put into the movie, it's what I don't put into the movie. It's a simplicity. It's knowing the mastery of where to put sound and where not to put sound, and not to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for me, that was great because it got a chance for me to stretch a very different muscle. And it's weird, and maybe it's back with music. I'm not as much a sound designer as in, isn't every sound I do amazing? And it's kind of like, I guess, being a guitar player where you want to show every lick and every flash that you've ever learned. For me, it's not about my chops. It's not about everything that I'm capable of doing. It's about assessing the story that I'm trying to tell and to figure out the tools that I have available to me and how do I best enhance the story that the director's trying to tell.
Okay. So one thing that's always amazed me is for every movie, you go out and you record your own effects, right?
Well, you know, look, I'd love to say that I record every single thing I do on every movie that I do, but that's not the reality. You know, I have a library. It's a huge library and it's ever growing. Kind of look at my library and look again what's good for it. Then I figure out what's needed. You know, what does my library not have? For instance, I did a Book of Life just recently. Mm-hmm. And I had crowd stuff from football games that I've done and football movies. And I said, none of it's right. First of all, it's in Mexico. It's got to have a sound. So I investigated and found the bullring in Tijuana. And I said, great, can we get 100 people to come out there and be my Walla group rather than doing Americans trying to do Mexican accents? And I said, and not only that, the visuals were in a bullring. So I said, then let's use a bullring. And let's use Mexican people rather than people trying to fake it. It's the real thing.
Yeah.
So we went out to Mexico and I recorded it in many, many channels and then converted it to Atmos. And it was amazing. I mean, you were there, didn't add any reverb to it. It was, I added some delay timings between tracks. That was it. Other than that, you put it in the room and you're in that bullring and it's everywhere around you. And, you know, it's sometimes a little more work at the beginning makes it a whole lot easier later.
Yeah.
And I did that, everything from Born on the Fourth, where I took crowds outside, because to do it inside with a Walla group, you know, come on, we got to run to the hooch. And, you know, and all the explosions go in and Cruz is doing his thing. And I just said, why don't we just go out to a park and record it outside? And then I just fit it against production and we're there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do a lot of that. I've done it so many different times. Another good instance is a movie called Lucky You with Curtis Hanson as the director, just a wonderful guy. And they really wanted authentic poker. So I went down to Bellagio and Binion's with their blessing, got to shut the music off, put microphones in my wrist, and it looked like I had headphones on, and they were microphones as well. So, you know, XYORTF. And recorded people playing poker. And then I started realizing the chips in Bellagio are actually made of clay and at Binion's are made of plastic. So I went to that depth and I said, I need to get those chips. Not only that, but when the pro players play, they flick the cards and snap it.
Hmm.
And I said, I need that sound too. So you know what's great is I kind of do career day sonically and I travel and I get to understand the environment that the movie's about and try to capture those sounds so that, you know, when a pro player or somebody is very familiar with it, hears those sounds, they're accurate or accurate enough.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in Hollywood, we want to make it embellished and a little more fun, but I don't know. I'd like to make it where, you know, it makes sense. So every movie I do, whether it's a submarine movie, but sometimes, you know, I will say there's certain things in life that don't make a whole lot of sound. And that's kind of boring to watch on the screen. So I'll enhance it. And it's always an illusion. My job is total illusions. If the moment you hear my sound and go, I hear it, I'm kind of failing. What I want you to do is watch the movie, hear the story, get sucked into the story, and absolutely believe that the sounds I'm creating are emanating, whether it's a rocket ship, a creature, or just, you know, whatever the movie's about.
That's a film composer say the same thing. If you notice my music, then I've actually done a bad job.
It is. And you know, when you asked before about, you know, what's the process before, you know, I get the script, I hear it, I pitch the movie, I sit down with the director, and you know, when I worked with Oliver Stone, he said something to me which kind of goes to the core of my career. I went to him at one point and said, "Hey, Oliver, what do you want?" And he said, "Scott, if I knew what I wanted, I don't need you. What I need you is to tell me what I need. You're the expert." And I said, "Great." And my whole career is kind of based on that. So I am the kind of person that will give my opinion. And so what I do is I kind of say, you know, I kind of listen to the director and try to get a feel for what he doesn't like. Not what he does like, but what he doesn't like. Because what you want is too big of a field, especially if that's not your specialty. But everybody can say, "Oh, I don't want it to sound like this, and I don't want it to sound like that." And you go, "Okay, now let me tell you about the possibilities." With that information, let me, and sometimes I would vocalize it. And the funny story was, I was working a Flubber, and I was working with the director and the producer, and the producer was John Hughes, a wonderful guy. And I was trying to say, "What is Flubber going to sound like?" And so I started vocalizing it. And because I'm used to synths, because I'm thinking, you know, backwards, reversing, filters. These are things that we know. So I started emulating them with my voice. They liked it so much that I get a call from John and says, "Okay, look, I need Flubber by the end of the week." I said, "Great, but I have no clue what we're doing." He goes, "No, what I want you to do is, you know all those sounds you were doing with your mouth? Do that. Vocalize them." I said, "Great." So I vocalized them, sent it off, and then contacted them later. Said, "So we got to figure out what we're going to do for Flubber," because I thought Robin Williams would do it or something. He goes, "No, you're Flubber." I said, "Great." He goes, "I want to make some changes." And it was fun. It was a fun little trip. The guy worked with Danny Elfman and singing, you know, and doing the Mamba, you know. It was kind of fun. You know, again, as an artist, I try to change it up as much as I have the opportunity to. And I think through my career, I'm very proud that I haven't been pigeonholed in one thing or another. I do movies. I do video games. If you look at my credits, they're all over the place stylistically. And I feel fortunate that I've been able to do that.
Yeah, I want to get into video games in a little bit, but let's stay with film for a second.
Sure.
You always tell me about all the microphones you're using. You must have an enormous collection.
I do. I collect microphones and anything that I could put through a microphone, like weird tubes and stuff. They're the colors. I consider myself, not to be corny, but an audio photographer. And I got to figure out what lens I want to capture what I hear. And to me, every microphone excels at something, has a color. Some have no coloration. Some have certain characteristics. And some have a lot of coloration. I love that. So, I collect all sorts of microphones of every type. Again, it just depends on what I want to record. And also, when I do record, sometimes I don't know what I need, honestly. So I'll put up, like when we did the Bullring, I must have used like 30 mics.
And you recorded to what?
Usually sound devices.
Okay. So you had a bunch of them locked
788,
together.
788, Adiva, your usual stuff.
Yeah. Boy, so you have a huge collection of stuff then just for field recording.
I do. I mean, you know, Sanken, Sennheiser, Neumanns, Shaps. I mean, just all sorts of things. And I keep buying new stuff, too. I just bought the new Sanken 100K mic because I like the upper frequency. So when I drop pitch, I like it. I've also bought Sennheiser 8040s and the 800 series. So I got a group of those. I've got two 5.1 mics or five-channel mics, a Sanken mic, which is more of a shotgun, like a multi-channel shotgun in five channels. And I love the reach. So I can be far away and has a really nice reach to it. But it doesn't have a lot of low end. DPA, I've got the 5100. which kind of sounds like the way you hear, but which sometimes is accurate, but sometimes not exciting.
Yeah.
Just depends on what you want. Some mics are cool, but they're a little noisy. Some mics aren't noisy, but they're accurate. I've got all these dynamic mics. And then I grabbed all the stuff that I did for music. So I got 57s and 421s and 441s. And I've got the Soundlux mics, which are now David Bach. And I got 251 and 47s and 67s and 87 types. I've got tons of contact mics. Underwater. I have a hydrophone when I did underwater. I did a submarine movie. And it was great because I did a submarine movie and I had this jacuzzi that had these twirling jets. And I would run the mic by it and that would be my torpedo.
You know? Makes sense, though. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and it's and then I put the contact mic and the underwater mic on my air conditioning, slowed it down, and that was the engines for the submarine.
Wow.
Again, it, you know, there's no book to tell you how to do this. You just walk around thinking, oh, I could do this and I can do that. And I use my voice a lot. So I've got the SM7 as well. Similar mic to, I think, what you're using.
Yeah, exactly right, yeah.
And, you know, because I wanted something a little bit different. You know, right now I'm looking at a couple ribbons. There's an AEA ribbon, my new ribbon that came out with that. I don't own a ribbon yet. So maybe, you know, because I'm thinking if I want to do glass crashes and things that have very high transients that with a condenser mic might be a little brittle.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if a ribbon might work and it might be a great idea and it doesn't work.
Yeah. 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 Right.
That's right.
When you record something, do you ever record something knowing that you're going to have to affect it later? You're going to have to twist it and turn it.
All the time. Guns. Record guns and, you know, it has such a huge dynamic range that we got to smash it in some form of, or way when we bring it back. I'd say 80% of what I record, I know I'm going to manipulate in some way, especially in the design side. If it's just sound effects, you know, door opens, door closes, cars and all that stuff, probably not, but who knows? I mean, you know, I think the whole point of sound effects and sound design is you do manipulate it. The question is, do you manipulate things in a way that makes it now non-realistic or synthetic?
Mm, yeah.
And the moment, you know, and I'd say probably 90% of what I do has to feel organic. So however I do it, it has to always be organic.
Is there ever a time when you do it intentionally so it doesn't feel like that?
Absolutely, sci-fi. And then you got to figure out, you know, what the approaches were. And, you know, I've been doing it for so long. It started off with beeps and boops. And then I went, yeah, you know, computers don't beep and boop. So I kind of hate that.
Yeah.
So then I started getting into hard drive chugs. And I would find, like, old emus. And all these things that would ratchet on the on these hard drives. And I did that. So when I did a Runaway Jury, they had this whole computer center. So I took different fans and different chugs and different types of typewriters. And I used what I thought at that time represented computers. And then occasionally to keep, you know, return beeps and a couple key things. But, you know, I think the psychology that if you were using a computer and everything was beeping and booping, you'd lose your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, on the same time, I've done what I call Bitchin' Betty, which is a aircraft term for a talking computer. I did that, you know, when I did Pacific Rim, I thought it would be really cool to have a basically the Jaeger, the robot that you're controlling, to talk. And Guillermo and I talked about that early on, and then he thought that was a great idea, and then we just started running with ideas and how to use it and where not to use it, and I've done that a ton.
Yeah.
And also, I think it helps propel the story.
Okay, so now you've recorded your effects, and then you get back to the studio. Then what?
Then you have a long time to go through it all because you go, oh, you know, I'm going to record like 16 to 30 tracks and I'm going to record it for like 8 hours. And then it takes you like months. So you find ways, you know, you try to pass it off to somebody to go take out all the dead air or the big dead air spots. And then you try to condense and you start quickly going through what mics sound good and what mics don't. Normally, I always know how to get a good sound. but I want sometimes something special. So I'll always set up mics that I know are tried and true and they will always work. They may not be the best, but they always work. And then I'll sit there and go, hey, I've got this wild idea. Like when I was recording Guns, I had a parabolic and I used a piece of wood and mic'd the first reflection off the wood. Wow. So I would cut back the airwave to hit the diaphragm, you know. The wood sounded like somebody kept knocking on a piece of wood, like. And I went, wow, what a great idea. It didn't work.
Yeah.
So, and the parabolic was just too weird. But you keep coming up with ideas, you know, with PZM on the chest of the shooter, like they do on drums. You know, what would be interesting? So you go in and you go with the expectation that those weird mics will come up with absolutely nothing. But maybe they'll come up as a diamond. Mm-hmm. So I like to experiment with that. That's probably why I use more mics than I need to.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go through that. You start librarying the sounds. And then you start figuring how you're going to use them. A lot of times I'll do a poll before a show or while I'm on a show that, I don't know, out of the poll, I may only use 20%, but I go, oh, this is a cool sound. This is a cool sound. Because what it does is it also inspires me. Or I may go, wow, you know, this is a cool sound, but I wonder if I have that sound. And if I don't, can I go out and record it?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of inspires you. And, you know, it's the concept of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everybody has a different way of working. I'd love to say that I figure it all out before I do it. Sometimes I can, and sometimes I don't know. I mean, I guess if I could figure it all out, there may be nothing new. So I want to explore. So push comes to shove, I can always come up with what I know works.
Yeah.
And Chronicles of Riddick, I wanted to do something different for the ships. I didn't want to use any jets. Everybody uses jets. And I didn't want to use animals. So I used my electric guitar through a Marshall. I went to Rob's house with two Eventides, and me and a couple other guys, and I would, I had a Floyd Rose, and I kind of de-strung it,
yeah,
and I'd hit it really hard, and then start bending up. As I'm bending up on the guitar, we're rising the pitch, in addition to me pitching up, of the Eventides.
You're doing it in real time?
In real time. And next thing I know, it sounded awesome. It didn't sound like a guitar.
Yeah.
Until I was up to pitch.
Yeah.
And I did that, and then I put different takes of that in different speakers.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, when the Basilica ship lifts up, it just sounds awesome, and it sounds like something you haven't heard before.
How did you come up with that? I mean, no, people wouldn't think of doing that.
I usually in the mornings when I wake up, I usually think about it all night long, and then I usually freak out and stress, like, oh my God, I'm never going to work again. I can't think of anything. Anyway, think, hey, I have an idea. So I don't know.
Okay. So now you got back to your studio. You've cataloged everything. You know what you're going to use. Then what happens?
Then I start figuring out, and we start, you know, putting it against a picture. And sometimes I go, wow, that's really great. You put a picture together and it doesn't work. And sometimes it does. And then you start cutting all the nuances to what you're going to create. And then you see if you like it. And then usually we do a temp dub. And then we start hearing the music for the first time. And then we find out the music is big orchestral and you did all this really cool detail and it's a big score and nothing's cutting.
Wow.
So then you do temp two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Find sounds that cut. And then you find a dance. I like to talk to the composers before I start a project. I did a movie called Alive about the plane crash with all the soccer team.
Right, right.
In the Andes. And I love, it was James Newton Howard, which I'm a huge fan of. And he had this beautiful guitar piece coming out. And my concept was to build the plane crash so big and rock the room as loud as the room could go to kind of compress everybody's ears on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
and vibrate low end, modulate things, undulating. And then the moment the plane hits, we go into dead silence, where the only thing you hear is one little creak. And then I did this wind that had a little tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure the tone was in key of the music.
Wow.
The guitar comes out. It all blended in.
Yeah.
So I asked him, what key are you in? And I made sure that I was in that key with the wind.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not by accident. The attention to detail on these projects can be excruciating.
Okay. So now you're putting it all together. How long does that take before you get to the dub stage?
Longer than you think. You know, it depends. I've done some movies really quickly. I need 4 to 6 weeks before I ever hit a mix stage in any way. But there's different strategies. I mean, I've done some movies in 2 weeks before first temp.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific Rim, I was on it for 18 months.
Wow.
Which is unusual. That's very unusual. But usually, I'd like 6 weeks before I do anything, before I mix anything. And then that's temp one. Temp two, it might just be a fix. You know, and then at that point, it's no longer about me and my design. It's more about helping the picture cutter and the director, supporting their story via the cuts, mm-hmm. what they're taking out, what they're putting in. I've already established the dynamics and the key sounds for the movie.
Yeah.
Then we get, you know, go through all the iterations for as many temps as needed. Then we get to the final. And at that point, I start putting the details in. I'll put the extra Foley in, all the footsteps, the movements, all those little flowers on top of the cake.
At that point, really? You wait that long?
Yeah. Well, because, the problem I have with, let's say, Foley is if I Foley and then they add another 30 seconds or even 5 seconds, well, I got to make sure I match it.
Yeah.
So why spend all the money and then chase all these details? Now, if let's say it's a scene where you got one guy, it's the dead man walking or the lonely man walking down the corridor, I'll do the footstep because it's important that that sound happened for the temp. So when the audience sees it for the first time, they understand what's happening. But like all those little details, no, I wait to the very end.
Mm-hmm. And it's okay with the director?
Oh, always. Yeah. I mean, as long as a lot of times it's some of the stuff that people don't even know we do. And I got to go somewhere. I got to kick it up. But like, for instance, like in Pacific Rim, you know, once the CG was done, if you play it for somebody, the Kaju, the creatures, they have to be great. They have to be understood. They have to be created. Because you can't go, imagine it sounds better.
Yeah.
You know, imagine guitar solo here.
Yeah, right.
It just doesn't, you know, you got to get that high string with the vibrato. And so you emotionally have to push those buttons and hit all the big moments in whatever show that is. And then all the little details. Because you got to remember, my music's temp too. I don't have final music.
Oh, of course. Yeah, right. Okay, so when you're doing the final mix then, how much do you usually change? Can it change a lot?
Yeah, it can. You know, because we don't know what the music's going to do.
And you're changing it on the stage then?
Yeah, and then what I'll do is I kind of go from being the sound designer-ish to more the sound soup and working with the mixers. And at that point, it's no longer about what I created. And now it's about what best works in any given moment. And what I mean by that is, let's say I get a scene and the melody's just pulling my heartstrings and it's taken me somewhere. I may have done all this design and I've been like, you know what? Get rid of my stuff. It doesn't take us anywhere.
Yeah.
Even if I spend a month doing it, it's not right. So at that point, decisions need to be made as to what's the best use of emotion.
Yeah.
There are times where I go, the music's not doing anything. It's just vamping along, keeping time. Let's simplify it because I get a lot of sound effects that really need to be heard because they're enhancing the story or enhancing the emotions.
Yeah.
Or we try to dance in ways where we'll find if there's an instrument in the score that's clashing with things. They're using gongs or things that just, because it sounded good. A lot of composers only listen, you know, to their music and maybe just dialogue. But when you start putting it all together, you know, what's the best use? At the beginning, if I get a big gunfight, I might want to hear the guns at the beginning just to establish it. Big guns, are they exotics? Are they World War II realistic? Are they lasers? What are they? But after a while, they just becomes bang, 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 you know, and you're like, okay, I've heard it. So at any given moment, I think what I try to do is figure out how to keep moving the story forward. I did one with swords. I mean, it was great at the swords and big swords, and it was really great. And after a while, I'm like, who cares? Sword, and I got to cut it all, but I know I'm not going to use it all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At that point, I'm waiting for the music to do something and go, oh, look, the melody's coming. Ah.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, let me pull back and then let the music carry it. And then there's thousands of decisions that are happening daily.
How many tracks are you supplying to the stage?
That's a dangerous question for me.
I should tell the people that are listening, you're smiling as you're...
Yeah, I am smiling. Yeah. Okay, so... the most I've ever used is 2,000.
2,000 tracks?
Yes. And the least I do is 500. And let me explain why.
Yes, okay, please.
First of all, if I'm doing in 7-1, that means every element can theoretically have 8 tracks.
Sure.
So take whatever you have divided by 8. When you deal with Atmos, I could now have 50 speaker locations, 40 speaker locations. Where I go, I want, you know, some elements to be in different places. Number one. Number two, I go out wide. You know, the concept is tape is cheap. I go out wide for a reason, and that's based on categories. I can kill a mixer in 8 to 16 tracks. Why? Because if you do not have any logic to the layout in which you work in, then nothing is predictable. And really what it comes down to is groupers. Mm. I try to make my movies fit within, let's say, 32 groupers. And that's the categories. So in music terms, it would be drums.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you may say, great, but I want to be able to change the hi-hat. Well, then you click it, you spill those tracks out, and you go after the hi-hat. So like with Pacific Rim, which is 2,000 tracks, you know, I've got the Kaju. Well, the creature might consist of 30 tracks of different elements. Now, it's not a 2,000 tracks at all times.
Yeah.
You know, one reel may have only been 500 or 600 tracks. But when I've got, you know, four robots and 6 creatures all fighting in a single reel, well, there's no way, if I marry the stuff together, there's no way to have control over it. So you got the rain, you got the creaks, you got normal Foley, you got dialogue, you got all these different elements that go into it that you want to be able to have some kind of control over potentially.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, the other part, which I've had great success, is that by having so many tracks, as CG updates, and it always does until the very, very, very end, if I knew we'd need to extend out the decay of a gunshot, it's not married to anything. I just take a track, trim it out, I'm done. So my fixes take me 10 seconds. If I build it together, then I got to unwind it, go in, find the elements, build it back together, and do it, and come back.
Yeah, yeah.
There's pros and cons to all of it. It really comes down to how much time you have and how, you know, how much flexibility you want to have and, you know, speed. So to me, it just doesn't matter. The track count is kind of irrelevant. It all comes down to groupers.
How do you deliver 2,000 tracks? I mean, how does that work? How does that? It's hard to.
But you got to remember, each Pro Tool system now is 500 tracks.
Yeah. Okay.
6-2. So, you know, 6 systems get you, you know, or whatever the math is. But I remember I had 4 to 6 systems, Pro Tool systems, just for effects. On Pacific Rim, and then we had the dialogue, the Walla Group, the ADR. I recorded a bunch of Chinese people in 5-1 in one of the big shooting stages to get that kind of reverberant echo.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's all those tracks, and then music had tons of tracks. You know, music sometimes delivering 64 to 120 tracks. It depends on who the composer is and yada, yada, yada. So, yeah, next thing you know, yeah, you're tapping around 2,000.
Well, let's talk about ambience for a second. So let's say you're doing gunshots then. Are you recording the ambience as well, or are you just looking for the primary transient, the primary sound?
No, when I record guns, a lot of times we use 20 to 30 mics because and where you record a gun is very important. So I try to find those canyons that have the right echo,
mm-hmm.
or not echo, depends on what I'm doing. And I have mics that are actually miking the echoes of that canyon or that valley,
mm-hmm.
for that very reason. So no, reverb can't do it. It's not, I mean, there's no really great reverbs out there that'll make it sound like the street.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Okay, so let's say you have to add ambience to something.
Sure.
How is that done? Do you actually have the plugin on the stage so you can manipulate it, or is that recorded when you deliver it to them? How does that work?
Yes and yes. Usually, I'll make everything fit within the environment that it needs to be in for the most part. But what happens is, let's say I record something that has a 2-second delay on it. Sounds great. Feels right. Then you put music on it, and the 2-second delay is now gone. It sounds like a half a second.
Yeah.
Because music's masking the decay. So then you put a reverb on it that's 5 or 6 seconds, which really sounds like it's 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So it depends how big the music is. It depends how long you want the decay to be. There's a couple different areas. So reverb does add to it. But a lot of times when I'm trying to find a realistic space, like if I want indoor guns, then let me record it indoors. If I want outdoors, let me record it outdoors. There's no magic reverb that's going to take me there.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, so now we get the picture on what's happening on a movie, but how about the differences on a video game? You do a lot of video games as well. It can't be that intense.
That's some ways more. So it's different. So let's talk about the gun, which is a good instance. So in a video game, you're dealing with an XYZ coordinate, left, right, and depth of field. So let's say the guy's running at you, a guy's running at you with a gun. And let's say it's one of your buddies who's shooting past you. Well, when he's distant, he has that distant gun crack. And as he comes running at you, you start hearing the mechanism, you start hearing the bullets coming out of the gun, and all these little details. Well, each of those details have been mic'd at those distances.
Okay.
And it's crossfaded as it goes through Z plane. So all of a sudden, you need to be able to record the depth of field. And there is no mixer. The mixer it's kind of like setting up a sampler. You want drum samples played low. So if you want to create a good drum machine, do you just take the volume of a hard hit and you bring the volume down? No, right. You play it softer.
I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Same concept. So when you look at how to create a good drum patch, it's the same way as how to create a good gun patch.
Got it. Okay. So, but do you have as many tracks then when you're doing a video game?
But you got to remember everything you see has the potential of having a hook. Uh-huh. And that's something you can hang a sound on. So the question becomes, not only is it what you see, but sometimes what you can't see. For instance, do you want to hear any footsteps to the guy that's coming up behind you as a tool to know that he's behind you?
Yeah.
Yes, sometimes no. Then the other part is how much, because it's dealing with the physics engine. When two things collide, they make a sound. So, like, you know, we had a monster that had, like, I don't know, 24, 38 legs, like a centipede monster. And theoretically, when every single foot hit the ground, they made a sound.
Wow.
So you start putting that together and you go, wow, that so doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now you've got to start making decisions of priority. How many footsteps do you want to hear? Well, you want to hear more than two because you see all these legs. But maybe 6 or 7 will be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have primary legs and secondary legs because you want one to focus on and the other ones to be a little more muted on the high end, so it becomes more ear candy rather than specific sound. Complex.
How long does it take you to do a video game as compared to a movie?
I know
it varies. Movies vary in time, but do you have the same thing happening in a video game as well?
No, video games can take a year to make. It depends. It's never, you know, a lot of times as an independent contractor, I'm not working in-house. But, you know, I mean, some games can be faster, but you do in phases. You'll do a little bit, they'll integrate it, put it in, then do a little more of the integrated, a little more integrated. They keep playing it. Then you start seeing what works, what doesn't work.
Is there a script?
There is a game design doc that describes the game. And sometimes what they do is they call what they do a vertical slice of the game, which is kind of like a scene. Guy jumps into a courtyard, and now he's got to fight his way out. And that's all you see. And they use it sometimes as promo to pitch the game to see if the game works. And then you do that vertical slice. So, you know, there'll be thousands of dialogue assets. There could be 1,000 effects assets. So instead of, like, in film, use Pro Tools to be able to create it, and everything's linear and long. You've got to think in a video game of using a sampler.
Oh, yeah.
Because every time you hit a key, it's what the computer's doing.
Yeah.
Now, music could be streamed, BGs can be streamed, so that could be more longer, you know, loops of 10 seconds, 30 seconds, 3 minutes. But you need to have little bite sizes, and there's tons of them. And the amount is based on the platform that you use. You know, the big consoles, PlayStation and Xbox, can handle more. Your iPhone can handle less.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to how you want to prioritize the sounds that you think you need to hear. And if you do too much, you're going to sound like mud. Yeah. So you've got to kind of hear how it's going to sound before you do it, and then work backwards.
Wow. Yeah, you know, this is fascinating because we've known each other for a long time. And I learned so much in this conversation. Even though we've talked about this before, I don't think we ever talked in this depth. Yeah. Or at least, you know, in the same sequence that you're telling me how things work. It's really fascinating. It's great. I know you're running short on time, so I don't want to keep you too much longer. One last question.
Sure.
I ask this of everybody because it's kind of like, this is one of the things that's kind of universal, no matter where you're at in the entertainment business. And that's, what big lesson have you learned? What's the major business advice that you've either learned yourself or someone imparted to you during your career?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's so much. You know, I think it comes down to this. You know, what's the secret of success? You know, what is it? Quite a bit of insanity. I think you've got to be a little crazy. I think, look, ultimately, you know, all of us who went into the entertainment business, whether it's music, film, games, we went into a business that all our family members pleaded to us not to do.
Exactly right.
They went, you know, I've had so many relatives go, you're in the business. Tell so-and-so he shouldn't do it. And I think it comes down to this. If you have a passion, whether you're a musician or anything in the creative arts, look, it's going to be hard, but you don't care because it's what you do. It's what you have to do. It's what you want to do. You know, I keep wondering, oh, my God, what am I going to do when I actually have to get a job? Because even today, I still feel like I'm playing. And, you know, I feel fortunate what I do. I feel passion. You know, we're going to put hours in, and the pressure is going to be so high. And, you know, and everything's on the line because everything you do is judged by the last thing you've done. And it's all this craziness. But love what you do. Be passionate about what you do. It should be everything to you, you know. And when you submerge yourself in it, especially when you're young and before you get into any kind of relationships, it is what you do. And hopefully the person who is with you goes for the ride about what you do and what's important to you. And they know what's going to happen. And you put crazy hours in, and sometimes you don't. And you've got insecurities, you know, I don't care who you are. You go, oh my God, this is great. It's great. I'm never going to work again. and my wife rolls her eyes, and you know, you go through these weird little creative swings, but ultimately it's got to come down that you care. And people really love people who care, who are passionate, who have a love for what they're doing and what you're doing, and you share in that love. And if there's a single thing I could tell people is eat, live, breathe it, move to wherever you got to go, who does it, envelope in it, and that's kind of, I think, the lesson that I've learned.
I can't agree with you more. This has been great, Scott. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure.
To find out more about Scott, you can go to formosagroup.com/talent. That's Formosa Group, Formosa Group.com/talent. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thanks, Steve, for helping me put this together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on Stitcher or iTunes. At BobbyOsinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.